The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
From New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Streaming video live in our studio in New York City. You can watch today's program if you choose by going to progressiveradionetwork.com or GaryKnoll.com. Our program today is one for those who would like to think on a deeper level about the issues that we're facing. I'm going to do a series of commentaries this week, my own and others, and combinations, on showing why the efforts in Wisconsin to challenge the government and those people behind the government actions are not going to work unless a lot more is done. What is that more? I'll discuss that. And giving historical understanding, I'm going to take you back to 1848 in France, Germany, the Prussian Empire, and show you how people's revolts, going to the streets, demonstrating, which caused immediate action, later on was completely usurped and undermined by those still in power. And that will be the case in Tunisia and Egypt, in other countries, as well as in the United States, including in Wisconsin. But I want to take you on a history lesson to do that, and that takes a little time. That will commence tomorrow. But today, a commentary from Pulitzer Prize-winning author Chris Hedges from commondreams.org. Then a short, very short commentary on our issues from Paul Craig Roberts. Paul Craig Roberts is a former Secretary of the Treasury, his professor, and he's going to set the record straight that all these figures that virtually all the media, left and right, have been talking about unemployment, how good everything is, they're all lies. We'll show you the truth. And if you really want to help Americans who are in trouble, don't cut back on their social programs. That's inhumane. Cut back on the $1.3 trillion spent on the military, while the rest of us fight over crumbs. My guest in the second part of our program will be one you won't forget. Liam McGrath Goodman is going to talk about how a small group of renegades in the commodity exchange hijacked the world's oil market and its role in the future pricing of oil. If you remember 2 years ago, when oil went from $47 a barrel to $147 a barrel, it took me under 2 hours of determining by simple statistics, looking at market forces of who bought that oil, that there was no change in supply and demand. Now, normally, if you have a great demand and a low supply, that can force up prices. Or if you have a great deal of supply and you don't have any demand, that lowers prices. Well, there was no difference in supply and demand, yet there was a 200% difference in the price, 150% difference in the price of oil. That was all speculation. Why is it the media didn't get that story? No hearings on it. No one was held accountable. The amount of money that that small group of people made off that is just mind-numbing, and I'll get to that when I get to my guest. They're doing it again. And I believe that there are some positive solutions that we can begin enacting now. As you see, we have a full show. I will not be taking calls today. Let's begin by looking at the latest in health, nutrition, and alternative healing. Keep in mind that I go to the original scientific literature, not the mainstream media, because it's bias, it's self-censoring, and it is not capable at this time of understanding what real healing is, nor is it capable of being honest about what causes disease. For example, from the Annals of Neurology, Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, Professor of Neurology, Dr. Hoke, MD, PhD, and associates, showed that it was the aging of our mitochondria that was the culprit in peripheral neuropathy. I might mention it's also the culprit in why you get tired as you get older, why you don't have the stamina, why you can't run as fast or have as strong as muscles. Now, that doesn't mean you couldn't. In fact, some of us, Sam Skinner, Thelma Wilson, Sid Howard, myself, are disproving that. In fact, we are still competing at levels that we did earlier, 20 years ago, and still able to hold back that aging clock. Why? Is our biochemistry different? Yes. And why is that? Because we feed the mitochondria, the little energy factories in the cell. Now, in your heart, you have an enormous amount of mitochondria. The brain and the heart together represent probably 5 or 6 pounds. Not much. And yet they use over 25% of the total energy expended in the body. So when the mitochondria, which create the energy through a process with ATP, adenosine triphosphate, when that little energy factory, and there could be hundreds, even thousands, it per cell, when that diminishes, then you don't think as well, you don't have the same memory, cognition, your heart can't beat the same. You run the risk of a heart attack. Your muscles are not as strong. And they're finally acknowledging this. They're acknowledging that peripheral neuropathy is due to this weakness in there. So they don't tell you the solution. Well, I will. Here are some really good solutions for those of you who are having brain fatigue, brain fog, weakness in your muscles, neuropathy. Go to 4 simple nutrients. There are many more, but here are 4. If you start listing too many, people can't get them. These you can. NADH, 20 milligrams, 4 times a day. If you have chronic fatigue syndrome, or hepatitis, or AIDS, or cancer, I would take you up to 200 milligrams in divided doses. Coenzyme Q10, ubiquidone. Q10, 200 milligrams, 3 times a day. That's a minimum. We have been under-potentizing people on Q10, way under what they should have. People who have serious brain deficiencies, including people, let's say, with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, I have them up 3,000, and that's why they're getting tremendous benefit. Then we have very important L-carnitine, 500 milligrams twice a day. And vitamin E with tocotrienols, that's 2 separate units. Vitamin E from mixed tocopherol, that means you're getting multiple different types of tocopherol, not just alpha tocopherol or gamma tocopherol, but beta and theta as well. 600 units. And then after a month, 1,200 twice a day. And the tocotrienols, 200 units twice a day. Now, there are many other things that can cause energy, including D-ribose and creatine monohydrate and glutamine. But I'm just sticking with the ones that will help across the board. Brain and heart. That's what we're going to do today. All right? So then watch how much sharper you are, how longer you can read without getting tired, how quicker you are with your energy, getting up and you really have the energy. More on that on another program. Wild mushrooms show very positive antioxidant potential. This is from Food Science and Technology, and it was done at the Mountain Research Center in Portugal, a major research center, and here's what it says. The roots of wild mushrooms could be important sources of bioactive compounds such as gamma tocopherol, what I just mentioned, quote, to be used in pharmaceutical or food industries. The authors of the research found that the wild fungi, Mycelia, M-Y-C-E-L-I-A, and possessed higher levels of total tocopherols than the mushroom's fruiting bodies, meaning the stem had more than the actual fruit of the mushroom. And it, quote, is a powerful source of gamma tocopherol. And the antioxidant properties, quote, of many organisms, particularly of wild mushrooms, with their content in antioxidant compounds, such as tocotrienols, can detoxify potentially damaging forms of oxidative free radicals. So what does this mean in lay language? It means that most people never eat wild mushrooms. That's okay. Wild mushrooms are plentiful. It's easy to go into any gourmet food store and find a lot of different mushrooms. Get the wild mushrooms, and where most people cut the stem off and just have the little cap to use because it's a little pithy, no. Use the whole mushroom, including the stem, and you'll be getting a lot of antioxidants, and that protects the cells. I have had so many people tell me, oh, gee whiz, you know, I'd like to take some vitamin E or some green powders, but I can't because my doctor says, you know, that I'm already on Coumadin, and they don't want my blood getting too thin, because then if I get a cut, I could bleed out, etc. This is the latest, and this is from Science Daily. Here's what it says. Quote, every 5 minutes, someone dies from a blood clot or deep vein thrombosis. Quote, each year, 180,000 Americans die as a result of pulmonary embolism, a complication from blood clots in the lungs. The Vascular Disease Foundation urges Americans, especially women, to learn about the risk of venous blood clots to help prevent these deaths. While men and women are at equal risk, the risk for deep vein thrombosis or blood clots varies depending upon where a woman is in her lifestyle, her hormone levels, and if she or her family has a history of clotting factors. Here, but they don't tell you what to do. All right, so I'll tell you how to prevent those clots in the first place. First and foremost, green juices naturally thin the blood. So let's say you woke up this morning and you decided to juice some cucumber and celery and apple. That's a great juice. That's going to thin your blood. Let's say you want to spike it with some vitamin C, which I recommend you do to every drink you have, including water. That'll spike your blood with vitamin C and thin your blood. Better than an aspirin, but an aspirin's going to kill upwards of anywhere from 4 to about 11,000 Americans. The non-steroidal anti-inflammatories that do the same thing as aspirins will kill about 24,000 Americans every year. Vitamin C kills no one, protects a lot of people, and thins the blood. Vitamin E and tocotrienols thin the blood and allow a spacing of the red blood cells so they don't clump together, what's called aggregation. Then, by not crossing your legs when you're sitting. If you cross your legs, you block the flow of blood. You remember, you have arteries going down, veins coming back, and there are little levers that open to allow blood to flow in. When you cross your legs, you're forcing those into a compressed position and closing them, much as if you have a water hose and you pinch it down. That's bad. That can cause clotting and poor circulation. Then, curcumin. 800 milligrams a day. That will help prevent that. 3 to 4,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day is great. And as far as food, listen carefully. This is important. An onion a day keeps a stroke away. My suggestion is a sweet onion like a Vidalia or 1040, a Maui onion. And you dice the onion, slice the onion, run it under cold water for a moment. That gets rid of some of the volatile oils, but still has all the sulfur-containing nutrients and the natural sulfurols, and that thins the blood. Garlic thins the blood. So there is no reason that we should be having this. But on the other hand, people are taking in foods like milk. If you watched a person's blood, and I've done this many times in the lab, you take a person's blood, and it has a certain color. You can put it under a dark tree microscope and you can see the shape and the size of the red blood cells. Then give that person a milkshake. And then a half hour later, take their blood again. It's all laced with these long little strings of dairy, of fat, and it clumps the cells together. So eat dairy and have a greater likelihood of a clot. Take meat and have a likelihood of a clot. Someone sent me a video of a big guy. He was probably around 500 pounds, eating in Arizona. What do they call it? A heart attack restaurant or something like that. Yeah, heart attack grill. And they have these waitresses dressed up as nurses. And people eat portions of food that you can't imagine because the stomach is relatively small. It's not large. It can expand, but that's not good. So this guy was shown eating a humongous amount of beef. I think it was 12 pounds. Anyhow, this guy just died of a heart attack. And just last week. And the question is, why in the world can't we learn some lessons? We don't need to be putting ourselves at risk. And if you are flying on an airplane, without exception, take all the things I just said before you get on the plane, and it's more than a four-hour flight, take them again in mid-flight. That helps keep that blood thin, because that's also where you're going to get some thrombosis. When you're in an airplane and your legs go out and down, you need to stretch the legs out. Keep your legs at a stretched angle. Keep pointing your toes up and back. Get up and walk up and down the aisle. Go up and down on the ball of the foot. And that at least keeps the circulation going. And how about this? Following up, this is the latest statistic that we have. And it says, quote, from Science Daily, 1 in 4 U.S. adults had high blood pressure last year. 60 million Americans age 18 and older were diagnosed with high blood pressure. My goodness, there is absolutely no reason for this. So let's get our hearts in shape and let's not put ourselves at risk. I'm Gary Knoll. That's our Health and Nutrition Alternative Medicine segment. Up in a moment with a lot more. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. Our guest in about 18 minutes from now will be Lee McGrath Goodwin. And we're going to talk about how a tiny group of people ended up manipulating the commodity exchange in such a way that they could control the price of oil. The amount of money they're making is staggering. But who's controlling the price of wheat and rice? Who's manipulating commodities? You've heard me say many times, I believe that all commodities essential to life should not be allowed by law to be traded for a profit. And yet, we're still allowing it. Nothing is being done on the left or right to stop this. We'll deal with that. Civilizations rise, they decay, and they die. Time, as the ancient Greeks argued, for individuals and for states is cyclical. As societies become more complex, they become inevitably more precarious. They become increasingly vulnerable. And as they begin to break down, there is a strange retreat by a terrified and confused population from reality, an inability to acknowledge the self-evident fragility and impending collapse. The elites at the end speak in phrases and jargon that do not correlate to reality. They retreat into isolated compounds, whether at the court of Versailles, the Forbidden City in China, or modern palatial estates. The elites indulge in unchecked hedonism, the accumulation of vaster wealth and extravagant consumption. They are deaf to the suffering of the masses who are repressed with greater and greater ferocity. Resources are more ruthlessly depleted until they are simply exhausted. And then the hollowed-out edifices collapse. The Roman and Sumerian empires fell this way. The Mayan elites, after clearing their forests and polluting their streams with silt and acids, retreated backwards into primitivism. As food and water shortages expand across the globe, as mounting poverty and misery trigger street protests in the Middle East and Africa and Europe, the elites do what all elites do and always have done. They launch more wars, build grander monuments to themselves, plunge their nations deeper into debt, and as it all unravels, they take it out on the backs of workers and the poor. The collapse of the global economy, which wiped out a staggering $40 trillion in wealth, was caused when our elites, after destroying our manufacturing base, and you've heard me mention this many times on this program, just since 2000, more than 44,000 corporations have either been closed or outsourced. You've also heard me say that there are people who are responsible, the progenitors, Michael Milken, T-Bone Pickens, Ivan Botsky, Carl Icahn, and Saul Steinberg, the original people who created the junk bond market and then began the corporate raiding, taking over companies, loading them with debt, and then stripping off their assets, taking massive profits, and then either destroying the business or outsourcing it to another country. Millions upon millions, I conservatively estimate over 30 million jobs in the last 30 years, have been lost in the United States. But as long as there were people able to take those jobs and take one job and from one company that didn't exist and rework it into another position, all was well. Today, there are no more jobs. And that's what we're seeing. The elites, to cover the losses, then looted the public treasury to begin the speculation all over again. They also, in the name of austerity, began dismantling basic social services, set out to break the last vestiges of unions, slashed jobs, froze wages, threw millions of people out of their homes, and stood by idly as we created a permanent underclass of unemployed and underemployed. The Mayan elite became, at the end, as anthropologist Ronald Wright notes, in A Short History of Progress, extremist or ultra-conservatives, squeezing the last drops of profit from nature and humanity. This is how all civilizations, including our own, acidify and die. The signs of imminent death may be undeniable. Common sense may cry out for a radical new resource in response. But the race towards self-immolation only accelerates because of intellectual moral paralysis. As Sigmund Freud grasped in his Beyond the Pleasure Principle, human societies are as intoxicated and blinded by their own headlong rush towards death and destruction as they are by the search for erotic fulfillment. The unrest in the Middle East, the implosion of national economies such as those of Ireland and Greece, the increasing anger of a beleaguered working class at home and abroad, the growing desperate human migrations, and the refusal to halt our relentless destruction of the ecosystem on which life depends are the harbingers of our own collapse and the consequences of the idiocy of our own elite and the folly of globalization. Protests that are not built around a complete reconfiguration of American society, including a rapid dismantling of the empire and the corporate state, can only forestall the inevitable. I will deal with this more on upcoming programs. We will be saved only with the birth of a new and militant radicalism, which seeks to dethrone our corrupt elite in all areas, so they no longer have power. We cannot do what the Democrats and Republicans are doing, even in Wisconsin. We cannot negotiate for better terms. You are still a prisoner to someone else's terms. Hello, Wisconsin. Finally, please step out of your left-wing pro-union position and look at the reality of the larger issue. When did you all encircle a home so it would not be foreclosed on and protect its inhabitants and say we will risk going to jail for our neighbor? And for every home you send someone out to foreclose on, we will be there with our arms linked, row upon row upon row. You will not have enough marshals or deputies to get through us. You will not have enough jail cells to hold all of us. And we will be responsible for seeing that 17 million hungry children are fed. But no, the people of Wisconsin did not protest the wars in Vietnam, or excuse me, the wars in Iraq, and the homeless or the loss of jobs until their own job became imperiled. And suddenly they found a voice. But it was unique and specific and isolated and monotheistic. My God, can't we realize how selfish we become? If you don't pull back and look at the larger picture, your victory will only be temporary. The global economy is built on the erroneous belief that the marketplace, read human greed, should dictate human behavior and that economies can expand eternally. Globalism works under the assumption that the ecosystem can continue to be battered by massive carbon emissions without major consequences. And the engine of global economic expansion is based on the assurance that there will always be plenty of cheap oil. The inability to confront simple truths about human nature and the natural world leaves the elite unable to articulate new social, economic, and political paradigms. They only look for ways to perpetuate a dying system. Thomas Friedman and the array of other propagandists, and that's all he is, for globalization make as much sense as Charlie Sheen on a bad day. Globalization, and thank you Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and all the other Clintonites that caused this, is the modern articulation of the ancient ideology used by the past elites to turn citizens into serfs and the natural world into a wasteland for profit. And the Democrats have been equally responsible. So get off your self-righteous position that somehow because you're on the left or liberal that you are the preferred ideology. You are not. You are co-conspirators in the destruction of all that once was sacred. And only those of you who are progressive and have broken from the rigidity of your ideology and did not get sucked into the Clinton or the Obama mess can understand that it is only through progressive ideals and true sacrifice that change will come. Pumping that oil, cutting down those trees, and catching those fish may benefit the elite by bringing them money or prestige, and yet be bad for society as a whole, including the children of the elite, in the long run. So said Jared Diamond in his essay, The Last Americans. Quote, why, Diamond writes, did the king's nobles not recognize and solve these problems? A major reason was that their attention was evidently focused on the short-term concerns of enriching themselves, waging wars, erecting monuments, competing with one another, and extracting enough food from the peasants to support all their activities. It is no different on Easter Island. The inhabitants, when they first settled the 64-square-mile island during the 5th century, found abundant fresh water and woods filled with the Chilean wine palm, a tree that can reach the size of an oak. Seafood, including fish, seals, porpoises, and turtles, and nesting seabirds were plentiful. Easter Island society, which split into an elaborate caste system of nobles and priests and commoners, had within 5 or 6 centuries swelled to 10,000 people. The natural resources were devoured and began to disappear. Forest clearance for the growing of crops would have led to population increase, but also to soil erosion and decline of soil fertility. Progressively, more land would have to have been cleared. Trees and shrubs would also be cut down for canoe building, firewood, house construction, and for the timbers and ropes needed in the movement and erection of statues. Palm fruits would be eaten, thus reducing rejuvenation of the palms. Rats introduced for food could have fed on the palm fruits, multiplying rapidly and completely preventing palm degeneration. None of it was done. Clans and later periods on Easter Island civilization competed to honor their ancestors by constructing larger and larger stone images, which demanded the last remnants of the timber, rope, and manpower on the island. By the year 1400, the woods were gone, the soil was eroded and washed into the sea. The islanders began to fight over old timbers and were reduced to eating their dogs and soon their nesting birds. The desperate islanders developed a belief system that posited that the erected stone gods, the Moai, would come to life and save them from disaster. This last retreat into magic characterizes all societies that fall into terminal decline. It is a frantic response to loss of control as well as despair and powerlessness. This desperate retreat into magic lends itself to the Cherokee ghost dance, the doomed Taki Anquai revolt against the Spanish invaders in Peru, and the Aztec prophecies of the 1530s. Civilizations in the last moments embrace a total subservience to reality, but from reality, a reality that becomes too bleak to be absorbed, and hence they cannot tolerate it. The modern belief of evangelical Christianity in the rapture, which does not exist in biblical literature, is no less fantastic. One that at once allows for the denial of global warming and the evolution of the absurd idea that the righteous will all be saved, floating naked into the heaven at the end of time. The faith that science and technology, which are morally neutral and serve human ambitions, will make the whole world again, is no less delusional. We offer up our magical thinking in secular as well as religious form. And finally, we think we have somehow escaped from the foibles of the past. We are certain that we are wiser and greater than those who went before us. We trust naively in the inevitability of our own salvation and those who cater to this false hope, especially as things deteriorate, receive our adulation and praise. We in the United States, the most arrogant country ever, only 5% of the world's population, are outraged if anyone tries to tell us we don't have a divine right to levels of consumption that squander 25% of the world's energy. President Jimmy Carter, when he suggested such consumption was probably not beneficial, became a figure of national ridicule. The worse it gets, the more we demand illusionary Ronald Reagan happy talk. What a fool, what a buffoon. Those willing to cater to fantasy and self-delusion are, because they make us politically passive, lavishly funded and promoted by corporate and oligarchical forces. And by the very end, we are joyfully led over the cliff by simpletons and lunatics, many of whom appear to be lining up for the Republican presidential nomination. All the events of 300 years ago on the small remote island of any significance to the world at large was asked by Bonn. We believe they are. We consider that Easter Island was a microcosm which provides a model for the whole planet. Like the Earth, Easter Island was an isolated system. The people there believed that they were the only survivors on Earth, all others land having sunk beneath the sea. They carried out for us the experiment of permitting unrestricted population growth, prolificate use of resources, destruction of the environment, and boundless confidence in their religion to take care of the future. The result was an ecological disaster leading to a population crash, a crash on a similar scale. 60% of the population on the planet would lead to the deaths of about 1.8 billion people, roughly 100 times the death toll of the Second World War. Do we have to repeat the experiment of this grand scale? Do we have to be as cynical as Henry Ford and say history is bunk? Would it not be more reasonable to learn the lesson of Easter Island history and apply it to the Earth Island on which we live? Human beings seem cursed to repeat these cycles of exploitation and collapse, and the greater the extent of the deterioration, the less they are able to comprehend what is happening around them. The Earth is littered with the physical remains of human folly and human hubris. We seem condemned as species to drive ourselves and our society towards extinction, although this moment appears to be denuded to the whole sad show of settled, civilized life that began 5,000 years ago. There's nothing left on the planet to seize. We're now spinning down the last remnants of the natural capital, including our forests, fossil fuel, air, and water. This time, when we go down, it will be global. There are no new lands to pillage, no new peoples to exploit. Technology, which has obliterated the constraints of time and space, has turned our global village into a global death trap. The fate of Easter Island will be writ large across the broad expanse of planet Earth. Chris Hedges, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Doll with us. I'm Gary Null. We're trying to reach our guest who is not picking up. As soon as she does, we'll go to her. In the interim, I will open our lines for you to share your thoughts on the issue of the day. I believe that the way that we're working to challenge authority, to show injustice, is not working and will not work because we're not looking at the larger problem. It's like taking out Mubarak. You've taken out one person who is corrupt. His entire system was corrupt. There are at least 5 million other Egyptians who were in the power base who are corrupt. The military-industrial complex, the spy agencies, the security agencies, all the major contractors were all corrupt. If you do not go in and change an entire system, then all you've done is given yourself a hollow victory initially, thinking that it is more than what it is. And that's true anywhere. Get rid of one president, put in another one, what has changed? Nothing. Show me the difference between Ronald Reagan, George Bush, Bill Clinton, and Obama. You can't. Not at the end of the day. Because look where we're at today. Look at the wars today. Did I miss something? Weren't we supposed to have a president that was going to take us out of wars instead of getting us deeper in, causing more human conflict, and becoming more secret? So we need to deal with this. Joining me in studio, Valerie and Jason. Valerie, we'll start with you.
Yeah, hi, Gary. I just want to congratulate you on your documentary, Death by Medicine. It's already been accepted into 8 festivals. You've won an official Best of Fest Award and the Rising Star Award with the Canadian Film Festival. And this is only the beginning of the season, so congratulations.
Thank you.
And also, I want to ask for some more volunteers. We've had great success. We've had wonderful people here with us the last week, but we still have some more work to do. We have our studio that we're trying to finish. It's almost done, and the video suite is almost finished. So please, if there's anyone out there that can come back this week and help us, give me a call, Valerie, at 646-926-5441. That's Valerie at 646-926-5441.
I won't be able to invite my audience to come see Death by Medicine until August, when we're qualifying it and Poverty Inc. and Greed Street all together. But then they will. But I'm glad to see that we won this Canadian award. Thank you. I was just told that we have now just got my guest up on the phone. Jason, we'll invite you to come back on our 3 o'clock show and talk about the issues you were going to say. Let's now go over and say hello to Lee McGrath Goodwin. She is an award-winning journalist writing on financial trading, big oil, banking, technology, and the intersection between commerce and culture. And her investigative reporting essays have appeared in Bloomberg, Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, The Guardian. Lee started her news career with the Dow Jones, and she was also an assignment reporter in London, New York. And for 7 years, she's researched and investigated the history of the exchange in New York, a commodity exchange, in oil and natural gas. In her recent book, The Asylum, The Renegades Who Hijacked the World's Oil Market, is based upon numerous interviews with former chairman of that index and the pit traders. And people are making a financial killing in the speculative trade of oil. Nice to have you with us today, Leah.
Hi, how are you?
Good. A couple of issues that we're all concerned about, and that is, if the actual supply and demand of a product has not changed, as was the case when oil went from 47 to 147, or even now, even with the tumultuous activities in Libya and the other Middle Eastern countries, there has still been no shortages of oil, and yet immediately the price went up. Someone's making money off this. Someone also makes money on foods and water and other things. Take us through this whole story, if you would, please, of how the speculators are making this money. Who are they? How much have they made? And most importantly, what we can do to stop this.
Wow, that's it's a many feather question. But the thing about the oil market is there's different interlocking layers of how it works. And when you just talk about the speculators, you're effectively talking about people who are out to make a fast profit, most of them, playing the oil trading game. And it's basically a gambling game. So when you see that there's something going on in the Middle East and you're playing this game, quote-unquote, you know prices are going to go up because the oil market's always on a hair trigger and very reactive and overreactive to anything in the Middle East. So you'll bid the market up right away just on the understanding that the market will be going up on that, regardless of supply situation in the immediate term. And so there's like certain rules of the game that the traders respond to right away. Restiveness in the Middle East is a very big trigger for upward movement in prices. So they'll just jump right on that right away, even if they don't think there's any reason to do it. They will just do it. So there's that part. Then you have the real supply-demand situation. We do have really good supply, but demand is going up again. The economy is recovering. Supply isn't going to be getting larger and larger with any sort of incredible speed because it hasn't for a long time. So demand will be growing faster as we go forward into this recovery cycle, especially with India and China and its demand going up. So the traders will just look at that and say, you know, that's going to be a higher price picture. And then further, we're having a harder time getting oil out of the ground. It's getting increasingly difficult, and the traders are very sensitive to the long-term picture for oil, which is not really good. And they're looking to the day when we are going to have to fight for every last drop, and they're very, very reactive to that as well. So the immediate supply isn't always the thing they're looking at. They're often looking at the fear factor in the future.
Last evening on 60 Minutes, they had the first segment showing a group of children with some parents who are going through financial rough times. And it showed that they had gone from their house into a van and then into a motel room and how they had to cope. At no time in this, for what they did, I thought the show was a good segment, but never once did they talk about why are all these kids and their families, one in five kids, they said, now in the poverty level in the United States. And he had a group of kids in the classroom and said, how many of you go to school hungry? You haven't had food? All the hands went up. Then how do you deal with that? Then he said, how do you deal with that hunger? Well, we're told to drink water. If you drink a lot of water, it makes the hunger go away. How many of you go to bed without any food in your belly? All the hands went up. And one girl says, well, about every other day we get some macaroni, but then sometimes we don't get that, so we just, whatever cereal we can have. And one girl said, when I go to school in the morning, I ask if someone's going to eat something that I haven't seen them eat. In other words, they haven't opened up their box of food, and if they don't, I'll try to make enough food that I can eat from other people not eating there. She said, but it's very humiliating. Now, at no point in that discussion was there why we are poor, who's responsible, is this something that could have been prevented, and should we, what is it that we're not being honest about who was really behind this? Now, I just finished filming, in fact, I'm filming this week to finish the last of it called Poverty Inc. I film people who cannot heat their whole home because they can't afford the price of oil, heating oil. I find people can't drive the way they used to because they can't afford gas. I find people can't afford medicine and food because they don't have enough. And yet when I look at the prices of these commodities, I see people making astronomical amounts of money who never have to care about heating or air conditioning or food or medicine. Could you tell us about the amount of money these people make, how they make it? Take us through the mercantile exchange, take us through the commodities exchange, and how the politicians allowed the legislation to be changed, not just the Glass-Steagall Act, but also Commodities Future Trading Act, that allowed this type of rampant exploitation, and why they're not taxed the way they should be on this, they're not prevented from trading in these commodities that can adversely affect other people. The forum is yours.
Thanks. I think your listeners would be really interested in knowing that people who've been in this market for a long time, the commodities traders themselves, especially the ones, the old-timers who were there in the 60s and are still there, they have seen even what they feel is an alarming trend toward what one person said to me last week. He said, this is becoming a ruling class situation where we have a ruling class in this country and their only interest is to exploit everybody else. And that at this point, we're seeing legislation that literally turns into pretzel shapes to allow that agenda to continue. And I can cite chapter and verse all kinds of legislation over the last several years where they pretended to address high oil prices and high gasoline prices in this market, which is based in this heavily guarded compound in downtown Manhattan. And they failed to do so, but they did a very good job looking like they put a little window dressing on and then put out a big press release always and told everyone, you know, this is what we're doing. It's going to be under control. It's really, it's a total shell game. Ordinary people should be outraged. This can be brought under control. It's not out of control. It can definitely be brought under control. But they choose not to. And whenever there's a discussion about, well, why don't we make sure traders don't have to put down a very small amount of money to trade a very large amount of oil? Why don't we do that? It's like the nuclear option was activated. Everybody gets lined up at Washington's doors and says, no, we can't do that. We'll destroy business. It will not destroy business. If you have money to trade, you should be using that money to trade, but you shouldn't be using nothing to trade. And right now you're seeing a lot of people with, you know, putting maybe 5% down on a $1 billion oil trade or a gas trade. And that is not, you know, obviously a good idea. Something else that's interesting, I think, that your listeners would be kind of shocked by. Recently, they floated in Washington a proposal to allow for trading of what is called box office futures, which would be futures market based on movies, like films that you go to see. And Hollywood absolutely went insane, and their lobby went into overdrive. They could not believe that there would be gambling on the future of movies and how much a movie would make at the box office. This was supposed to be a brand new cutting-edge market, and they just put a complete halt to it. Now, we can't trade on movie receipts, but we can trade oil, one of the most strategic and important precious commodities in the world. That is amazing. But it is understood now that this kind of gambling is very dangerous, and it could put ordinary people into a bad position where they can't afford to pay for their basic heating and driving costs anymore. And that's what we're seeing, and nothing is being done about it until people start really getting angry and either voting their legislators out of office, or calling them and insisting on a difference. We're going to see a lot more of this. And yes, the people who are making money are making a large amount of money. Just, it's a gambling game. So if you learn how to play the gambling game, it's just like going to Las Vegas. You can make a lot of money.
Okay, but I'm looking at numbers, and I took a look at what is the position of all the top 20 banks in credit default swaps or derivative positions. And whose money are they using to put themselves in these positions? Then I find out the Federal Reserve, which I believe should be closed, I believe is a completely corrupt organization, gave 21,000 transactions totaling $3.3 trillion actual cash, but guaranteeing another a total of $13 trillion, none of which was made public. Only Bernie Sanders, in putting one little clause into the financial allowed us to know this, but even when it was asked who specifically got the money, what was their collateral, what was their interest rate, what are the payment return terms, none of that was allowed. So all we know is the number of transactions of all these people. Then we find out by someone who leaks some information that all the financial houses in Wall Street got money, the banks got money, foreign banks got money, McDonald's got money, and Verizon got money, but the average human being is being thrown out of their house. They're paying outrageous amounts of money, increases in basic foods today, and a lot of this is based upon speculation. Well, the amount of money in speculative positions right now is over $600 trillion. And I'd like to know how in the world any responsible person writing or reporting in the financial field or any legislator who has oversight of anything going on in the financial field could not see that $600 trillion in gambling, when there is not that much amount of money in the actual world economy, is simply...
I know, it's very...
Could you explain that to us and the rationale behind this and why we can't just say all this is outlawed, outlawing derivative trading, outlawing credit default swaps, outlawing all these, and allowing no trading in a commodity essential to life, such as water, currencies, gas, oil, and food? Your thoughts, please.
I do believe that the gambling aspect and the speculative aspects of food and fuel in particular need to be taken seriously. And speculation has a very special and important place in the market's ecosystem, but it is not supposed to run the market itself. It's supposed to be a part. And what we're seeing is everybody wants to gamble, and nobody really wants to not gamble anymore. So it's become the thing that drives the market. Now, we could have some speculation, but we need to have better rules about how to play this game. Right now, it's a real free-for-all, and that's the problem. It's not the speculation itself so much as the fact that the rules of the playground are just not there and they're not enforced. And if they could do that, we would see a much more orderly situation. And I just want to explain briefly to your listeners what speculation is. This is a really basic example. But if you're a farmer and you make corn and you have good seasons and bad seasons, you might be completely destroyed by a bad season. Let's say there's not enough rain, you don't end up having enough corn. Or maybe there's too much corn that season and so prices go down and you can't sell enough to bankroll yourself for the next year of growing. So the futures market was developed really for farmers in the Midwest, who needed to sell corn next year and the year after today so they could lock in a higher price. And the speculator will step in and assume that price risk. So the speculator will say, yes, I'll pay you XYZ for corn right now for next year, and you deliver it to me next year. And if the farmer says, well, that's great, I know right up front I'm going to get this much for it, I can already plan in advance that I'm going to be okay. That's how it all started. Speculator steps in between the natural buyer and the natural seller of a product, the buyer being a consumer buying bread, and assumes price risk that the farmer doesn't want because he needs to focus on just growing the corn. So the speculator has a good role, but what's happened is the speculative side of things has taken over completely, and the rules have not been very well policed. We have a lot of people in Washington at the major regulatory agencies and senators, and also things like the Agricultural Committee, the Banking Committee, who are much more interested in using these jobs as stepping stones to Wall Street jobs that pay very good salaries. And they're effectively being bribed with future positions in the market, as a way of maybe paving certain things, making it easier for those who are trading and for banks to do what they want to do. And that's why a lot of these rules are not getting enforced or not being made. And it's a vicious circle. I mean, the last record high in oil prices, the New York Mercantile Exchange is where oil prices are traded, and that's what my book is all about, is the guys who ran this market and how they built it. And it's a character-driven narrative. So the chairman of that market, he fell into a diabetic coma right as oil prices were topping out, so he wasn't watching the market. The president and CEO of the market was the former head of the watchdog agency in Washington that was supposed to be babysitting the market, but he really wanted the CEO job, so he jumped. There's too many people scratching too many people's backs and not a whole lot being done. When I spoke with that CEO after oil prices went to their high, I asked him, his name is Jim Newsom, I asked him, so did you see what happened? I mean, who was driving it up so high? And he said, oh, I'm sure people were looking after it. He hadn't even looked. And this was his, this is his market. So it's just amazing to me.
Well, there was
the amount of just not caring.
No, and I don't believe in reform. I believe that that is the biggest excuse in the world to allow everything to remain the same, but give the faux impression that something has changed. I just believe that we should completely outlaw all trading in commodities essential life for profit, and yet regulate it in such a way that a farmer would have an ability to survive, and that can be done as a farmer, as a certified organic farmer. I can tell you I've got a lot of ideas, as a lot of other farmers do, that would help farmers, but we are never invited to the table. Our opinions are never brought forward. But you get a person that's never stepped foot on a farm that doesn't care about the farmers. They don't have to invest in anything, and yet they're going to make an astronomical amount of money. The speculators will make more money off what they do in trading commodities than the collective farmers' profits will be for all that they've grown. Something's terribly wrong with that scenario.
Yeah, no, it's a very, very broken market. I don't have much hope it's going to get fixed. The best we can hope for is that we move past the oil market, and as we move into new, more diverse, hopefully renewable energy options, we have a lot better regulation and more appreciation of how important these resources are and that they need to be respected and treated well and not used as a giant casino. But I don't think that one day we're going to wake up and it will stop.
No, the only way you wake up one day and it stops when the people finally get the courage to go to the streets and boycott or close down those operations and those individuals and make them held accountable. We just, worldwide, we lost $40 trillion. Not a single one of those major players is in jail for it. And something's wrong with our system of justice, our system of oversight, and reforming it won't work. You've got to transform it. You can't transform it till you recognize the problem, and the people and the talking heads on television are nothing more than propagandists. They are an embarrassment. If you watch them as I do, see what they're saying, they're like Geraldo Rivera on Fox putting on his cheerleader suit to cheerlead for the, you know, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Never a critical comment, and this is the way they are. Leah, thank you very much for your good book. It's called The Asylum, and for your good work.
Thanks. Hey, do you mind if I close out with a quote from the book?
Sure, go ahead.
I thought you might be really interested in hearing just, there was a great, actually, you know what? I'm going to just tell you what it is because it'll be much quicker. But there was a man who wrote to me while I was writing about this for the Wall Street Journal, and he wrote, you know, it's just like it was in England when, you know, when the English came and settled in America and they got away from, you know, just being pillaged and raped and exploited. They were sick of it, started the U.S. And he said, we're now back into that same place that they were in England when the only, you know, need for a middle class or a lower class was to find ways to exploit them. And the line he wrote that really stuck with me, he said, we are the cowering chickens our founding fathers would have despised. And you're talking about all these people on TV who don't seem to, you know, address what's going on. If Fox News or CNBC or any of these other major networks addressed it directly, they wouldn't have any guests because the people in power intend to stay in power and they do not want to be in a position where they're not treated respectfully and as if their side of the story is the only story. So there's going to be mass alienation for those who do speak out. And that's why so many don't.
I appreciate they're not inviting us to debate them. I wish they would. I look forward to seeing you debate them. I'd like to see you debate.
Well, thank you.
I'd like to see you debate Glenn Beck.
Well, you know, I wouldn't mind debating Glenn Beck. I'm sure he'd be fine. It'd be an interesting exchange.
Yeah.
Thank you very much,
Lee. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all very much for listening. Back in 2 hours. Have a nice day.
Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kempf. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.